Tirok. Darth Vader, wouldn't that be great?
I've got my lightsaber and all here, it sounds fantastic. Zing.
Yeah, I know, I'm crazy. I've been sick this week, so anything could happen tonight.
If you're interested in following up some of the things we've been talking about, two books that have been very helpful for me. First of all, Christianity on Trial by Carol and Shiflett. I think it's worth about $20. It's quite extensive in its coverage, and these two people are journalists, and it's well documented, so it's well worth a read if you'd like to get some of this material and stuff we won't be covering in this week. And then the second volume on your left here, For the Glory of God by Rodney Stark, and it's got a nice R-rated cover for those of you who are into that kind of thing. Rodney Stark has been regarded by many as probably the foremost American sociologist. People have put him in the same category as Emil Durkheim. Anyone heard of Durkheim? Some of you have. Anyone heard of Pareto? Pareto's Law? Some of you have. Max Weber? A few more. Okay, good, good. Well, some people put him in that same category. And he initially began as an atheist. He was interested in the role of religion in shaping Western society. And I just discovered this week, I was doing some web searching, trying to track some things down about reviews of this book and what have you, and discovered that it was while he was researching our topic tonight, namely the impact of Christianity on science, that he became a Christian and left his atheism and said, no, there's something more going on here. And so if you want to track him down, Rodney Stark is his name. We're hoping to get him at Regent one day, but we'll see if he'll come. He's written a number of books. And if you read them carefully, From the Rise of Christianity, which is a very interesting approach to how Christians impacted the early centuries of the Roman world, right up through this last one, I think you can actually see a bit of a change in the tone of his writing. It's a dangerous thing to study Christianity too closely, apparently. You just might end up changing your mind a little bit. So there you go. Now, tonight, I would like to look at the Jesus story and the birth of modern science. I'm going to turn that off. Is that all right? In fact, whether it is or isn't, I'm going to turn it off. So there you go. I just want to reiterate something that I said the last time we were here, and that is, I'm well aware that Christians have made some tragic and foolish mistakes. We're going to see a couple of those tonight as we talk about times when Christians have not responded well. I'm well aware of those mistakes, and I'm sure you are too. My problem is this, I only have about 50 minutes tonight. And from my perspective, I'm not going to waste my time telling you what many of your professors tell you over and over and over again, or the media tells you over and over and over again, about all the things that Christianity has done wrong. So if you think I'm kind of whitewashing, no, I'm not whitewashing. I just want to try and give you something to counter the massive negative material that you get. So I'm going to be focusing primarily on the positive things Christians have done. And you obviously need to hear that in the context of the broader environment. I'm not suggesting Christians are perfect. Right? Certainly, well, I don't know, maybe me. Let me think about that. No, my wife's looking at me, probably not. So I'm going to unapologetically, in the next few sessions, focus on the positive things. Is that okay? So yes, I'm aware of the negative stuff. We're just going to let some of that sit. If you want to talk about that in the discussion group, feel free to come later. But we'll leave it there. Now, how many of you know what happened in 1896? 1896? I missed that. What was that, sorry? I still didn't hear it. I'm deaf from many years of drumming, okay? You really have to shout this thing out. Come on, 1896, you should know this date. No, of course you don't know it. It's all right. It's one of the key dates that Rodney Stark mentions in his chapter on Christianity and science. It was the date a chap by the name of Andrew Dickinson White, who is the founder and president of Cornell University. Heard of Cornell University? Maybe you have. He wrote what is probably the single most influential book on the conflict between religion and science. Right, that's toward the very end of the 19th century. Among many things that he describes in this book is the story that you have learnt at school, no doubt, namely the famous story of Christopher Columbus, who discovered America because he persisted in his conviction that the world was round in spite of the stubborn ignorance of the church. It's wonderful reading, rattling good stuff, as Dixon White records it. The problem is, just about every word in the famous paragraph is a lie. It's not true. Every educated European knew the world was round. The Venerable Bede in the 7th century AD would teach this. And for the first 15 centuries of the church's history, it was known and taught that the world was indeed round. In fact, the one monumental study who's tried to discover views of the earth in terms of its shape amongst medieval scholarship has found no reference to anybody ever asserting the world was flat. In fact, the only references to the earth being flat are when medieval scholars are denouncing that view. Everybody knew this. Furthermore, Columbus's opponents were actually right and he was wrong. But the debate was not about the shape of the earth, it was about how large it was. And here, Columbus vastly underestimated the size of the earth. He thought it was round about 3,000 miles from the Canary Islands to Japan. Well, he was out by a factor of 500%. It's about 14,000. And if it hadn't been for the accident of North America, he would have sailed off and we would never have heard of him again, because his crew would have died out on this vast sea. And that's what his opponents were saying to him. They were right. You've underestimated the size of the earth. So it really was an accident for a man who was more foolhardy than wise. Now, if everybody knew the world was round in those days, how come we weren't told that? When I was at school, this is a story of Columbus I received. Why was that? How come I was never told that all medieval scholars knew the world was round and that it took Columbus to prove that somehow that was its shape? Well, the answer's pretty straightforward. Mr. White admitted that he wrote his book not because he was interested in science, but because there were some Christian people he did not like and he was determined to prove them fools and idiots. So much for scientific objectivity. But he's not alone in doing this. From Thomas Hobbes up through Carl Sagan and Richard Dawkins, false claims are consistently made about a so-called war between religion and science. But the fact is, this so-called war is largely a fiction which grows out of a much later battle fought at the end of the 19th century. And notice the two groups, listen carefully to the phrasing, the battle was between fundamentalist Darwinians and Christians. It was only later that fundamentalist Christians got involved, and then the whole thing went up in smoke. Fundamentalist Darwinians are the ones who were behind creating this myth of the so-called battle between religion and science. People like Huxley, otherwise known as Darwin's bulldog. The truth of the matter is, it's from the very beginning to the present, committed Christians have been at the forefront of both fostering and engaging in science. Folks, science is a Christian activity. It might not seem that now, but listen to this. You might remember last time when I got up to speak, I mentioned how I'd been visiting the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences in Beijing. and got chatting to some of the scholars there, and I was asking them, why are you interested in studying Christianity? And their response was, you might recall, well, if we look at world history, the only place that ever modernized was the Christian West. And we think there's a profound link between Christianity and modernization. That's why these atheists, Marxists, are studying Christianity. Now, you understand by about 1100 AD, there were three possible cradles for the scientific revolution: China, the Islamic world, and Europe. Nevertheless, in spite of the great discoveries and technological developments of China and the Islamic world, the fact is those developments died on the vine. So that within three or four centuries, it was Europe that had utterly eclipsed the other two, and continued to do so in spite of the ravages of the Black Death. And you've got to hear what that means. Three possible centres that could have given rise to modern science. But it's only in Europe, and even then, in the face of the devastation of the Black Death. Now, how does one explain this? Well, we'll come to that in just a moment. But in getting there, it's worthwhile remembering that often historians speak of this shift from the medieval period into what we would call the modern period, I guess, the so-called scientific revolution. And you probably get the impression from school that you had this dark period when then just suddenly out of the blue there was this flowering of enlightened thinking, hence the great scientific revolution. Right? When these free thinkers at last broke the benighted bonds of ignorant Christians. Right? It's probably the story you've heard. That's what I heard. Well, in fact, there was no such scientific revolution. What happened in the West was nothing more than the normal progression of a development that had begun long before in the philosophical inquiries of Christian scholastic scholars. Ever heard the word scholastic? Well, you probably have in terms of someone who's scholastic, but it used to be kind of an insult to call somebody a scholastic, because these people were deemed as pedantic, you know, arguing about fine points, how many angels could sit in the head of a pin or something like that, and regarded with deep disdain by most thinkers. That's how it was when I was at university. But the fact is, what happened in Europe was no surprise. It was simply building on the work of these scholastic scholars, and, believe it or not, the creative engineering of the monks working in their monasteries. Now, several factors lead up to this. First of all, last time we were here, we talked about how Christianity had impacted the first century. One thing we didn't mention, because it segues so well into this material, is that one of the most important things that Christianity contributed to the ancient world, and probably more than anything else, is responsible for what we now call the modern world, was the Christian sense of a future. Now, it's hard for us to imagine this, but the fact is, centuries of Greek philosophy had inculcated in people's minds the idea that life was simply an unending series of cycles. No real change, just round and round the merry-go-round. Pythagoras, 6th century BC. History is an unwavering and endlessly recurring cycle in which the soul passes through a series of incarnations. Heraclitus, a century later. The world is unmade by either God or man, its fire ever living, kindling and being extinguished in measures. And that's their view of history. You can understand that there's really not, you can't really talk of meaning or purpose in a world like that. Just maybe getting dizzy, but that's about it. Right? That's why there are no movements of revolution, in spite of Marxist historians' attempt to try and turn some movements of revolt into anticipations of the great Marxist revolution. Well, no, it never really happened. No demonstrations on the streets by people who are concerned for the environment. None of that kind of thing. Why not? Because you couldn't really change things. You were born into a certain strata in society, and that was it. It was the emergence of Christianity that freed individuals from the tyranny of this cyclical view and the idea that humans' fates were tied up with the stars. So if the stars were fixed, which is what the ancients thought, and your destiny was tied to the stars, there was no hope of any significant change. Now, it's true that there were some other people who believed in progress and who also questioned this cyclical view of history. But the fact is, it was really only Christian philosophers that brought progress and this questioning of the cycle together. And that unleashed, if you like, the modern world and took them beyond where their pagan and Jewish predecessors had been. Out of this came a sense of life having a purpose. History was going somewhere. The future could be better. And of course, if you know your first century eschatology well, you'll know they believed that heaven was going to do what? Come to earth. Absolutely. Creation was loved by God. That's why he gave his only begotten son. Remember John 3:16? For God so loved the cosmos, not our souls, not just human beings, but the cosmos. So Romans 8 tells us the whole creation is groaning, waiting for the revelation of the children of God, and waiting then for its redemption, not its destruction. Now, I'm not going to pursue this one again because I keep doing it, but you need to know the notion of going to heaven and the notion of a fiery destruction of creation at the end is actually a pagan idea and not actually Christian. Yeah, pursue that another time if you wish. You might want to pursue me immediately after. So this idea then, the modern world with its notion of progress, the possibility of improvement, of hope, all of which is so foundational to the modern world, are in fact specifically Christian in their origin. Specifically a Christian idea. Now, how did this all begin to take hold? Well, two things I want to look at that led to the rise of modern science from this scholastic period, the 11th and 12th centuries. First of all, the scholastic learning in Christian universities and engineering creativity. Let me quickly go through the second of those, creativity amongst the medieval monasteries, or among the medieval monasteries. You probably would never think to associate technology with a medieval world, would you? Would you tend to do that? Well, hopefully you'll think again after this. Lynn White, a historian of science, claims that the attitudes, motivations, and most of the basic skills of modern technology before the electronics revolution originated when? In the barbarian Middle Ages. Even a non-Christian like David Landy says, the sharp departure from widespread animistic beliefs, the triumph of linear time and Judeo-Christian respect for manual labour were the basic reasons for this peculiarly European cultivation of invention. Right, if you've got that sense, it's fairly complex. But he's basically saying it was the Christian worldview that led to this explosion of invention during this period. D.S.L. Cardwell speaks of the precocity, diversity, and importance of medieval techniques. These people were into technology. What kinds of things? Well, first of all, we'll start with St. Benedict in the 6th century. He was the godfather of all libraries, if you like, at least in the West. And we owe him much thanks for the preservation of Latin antiquities. And it's out of that body of literature that the Christian universities began to grow. Under his rule, monasteries became the chief repositories of learning and literature in Western Europe. Isn't that interesting? That's the Christian heritage. You go back in time, and the place where you found the most learning, literary, and artistic development was in the monasteries. You're a clever person, that's where you went. Now, what's changed in the churches, folks? What has happened that our preaching is so dumbed down that most of us have trouble staying awake when people are preaching? Isn't that true? Come on, I know it's true. I talk to people who can't find churches in Vancouver where they'll get anything that will challenge their thinking. Right? Pathetic sops served up to intelligent, bright young people, and you recognise it for what it is. Flummery, and so you daydream about other things. I know, you've told me. It's a shame, and we should never tolerate it. It's not the origins of Christianity. Not in Europe. These monasteries. They were the principal educators. Is that what Christians are known for? Christians known for their profound love of education? Would you guess that from listening to Sunday morning sermon? Well, don't put up with it. Don't put up with it. Don't be rude. Don't be aggressive. But tell your pastors that you will not put up with this anymore. You come to church on Sunday, you expect to get some decent stuff. And if they can't do it, step aside and let somebody else who can. It won't change unless you ask for it. And maybe some of you might in fact be part of that change. That'd be great. Some of you within intelligence and gifts of communication, be great if some of you felt called into the ministry, gave your life to preaching well, with content and passion, in a way that could transform people's lives. That'd be absolutely amazing. So here are these monks devoted to prayer and education and literature and art and making good wine and beer. Thank you, Lord. And what do? They clear, they plant, they build. That's what Christians do. Right? In the midst of kind of Europe having collapsed somewhat after the decline of the Roman Empire and just things began to fall apart, what do these monks do? They begin to plant, they build islands of education. And they, in fact, provide the foundation for European economic development. They developed the labour-saving heavy plough, one of the most significant developments in European history. The three-field system of crop rotation. You might have heard that the Roman age was kind of the Iron Age. No, it wasn't. They had some iron weapons, but it was mostly bronze. The real beginning of the Iron Age happened in the monasteries of Europe. Interesting thought, isn't it? Monks. Unprecedented use of iron. And the emergence of the village smithy on center stage in medieval villages. That's a major shift from the Roman world. Well, what did this do? These very successful economic enterprises. Huge leaps in productivity, nutrition. The average peasant in the medieval period was far better off than his counterpart in the Roman Empire. You might never guess that from watching the movies that come out of Hollywood, where people walk around mostly filthy and starving. If you've watched those medieval pictures. Actually, not so. And when we get to the story of Christians and charity, we'll talk about some of the monasteries and you'll see what was on the menu for people being taken care of by these monks. You might even want to become sick. Pretty impressive. So what do these people do? The moment you have that kind of productivity, you end up providing surplus finances, extra time, security, and the leisure, which are crucial for innovation. And that's what happened in these monasteries. They became fountains of new ideas. In the 12th century, the Cistercians had made the monastery the most efficient economic enterprise certainly Europe and probably even the world had ever seen. Think about that. Christians efficient at economic enterprises. And doing it as an act of worship toward God. Not two separate things. Where they thank God for the money they made because they cheated the people they worked with 6 days of the week and then came into church on Sunday on the seventh and said, oh, praise God, I'm a Christian and wealthier than the other people whom I've just ripped off. Not talking about that kind of thing. These Cistercian monks were the front runners in wool production in England and iron production in England and France. In the monasteries, they popularized the use of water wheels in iron production. The first water-powered forged trip hammer, these are these huge hammers that they use to forge steel, is found in an abbey. All reference to such hammers before 1200 come from Cistercian records. Think about that. Monasteries as iron foundries. Soon their estates had a remarkable assembly of water-powered machinery, from grinders to crushers, fulling mills to forge hammers and devices for tanneries. The horizontal axle windmill was perfected within a decade or two, appeared all across Europe. The blast furnace,
formerly attributed to China now looks like being independently developed in medieval Europe. The first attempts to utilize the power of steam resulted in the development of the steam-driven bellows. Where? In a monastery. They imported and refined the spinning wheel. They layered sand under pavement and solved the perennial problem of cracked roads that had plagued the Romans for centuries. The first mechanized manufacture of paper. Their improvements to printing set the stage for Gutenberg. France alone quarried more stone in two centuries than the total of ancient Egypt. Right? You think these people lived in dark ages and did nothing? Well, hopefully not. They developed musical notation, produced pipe organs of staggering complexity, invented crude eyeglasses, apparently the work of two Dominican friars, developed the world's first crankshafts, employed gunpowder in ways far beyond the imagination of the civilizations that first developed them. Cannon were developed in 1324 and within a year were known all over Western Europe, but apparently not in the monasteries. Likewise, the compass, once claimed to have been imported from China, it seems now again to have been developed independently in Europe. But whereas the Chinese seemed content to retain it as a crude device, it was the medieval Europeans who added the card and the sight, and who apparently used it on ships as a means of navigation, long before the Chinese thought about using it so. And here's the real zinger. 1,000 years ago, long before the Wright brothers, a monk at Malmesbury Abbey flew a glider several hundred feet. Hard to get the Yanks to admit that, though. That's why Roger Bacon in the 13th century would rattle on about flying machines. Why? Because the monks had already been experimenting with these things. In fact, we have records of clerics sermonizing on the benefits of technology. Giovanni di San Giamigino, 1323, right, has sermons eulogizing the need for technology. Now, we're a little nervous about that these days, but these are people whom technology is bringing many benefits. Gimple concludes, the Middle Ages introduced machinery into Europe on a scale no civilization had previously seen. That's Christians, folks. Now, would you ever guess from attending church on a Sunday morning that God cared less about technology? What have we done? We've turned following Jesus into this Gnostic, disembodied, feel good personally and privately, and we call that Christianity, and I don't think so. It's an anemic thing. It's not the thing that Jesus unleashed, which was about transforming this creation. That's what he was interested in. And these people understood that. This is my Father's world. And they prayed and they worked and they invented technology and they designed, they did art, and all of that was part of God's world. Whereas, as you know, go to most churches and you get the impression that God either hates art or only likes bad art. It's not how it was. Now, can I suggest, I am really serious about this. Because I think until we begin to regain this heritage, no one's going to take Christians seriously, and why should they? Because most of it is completely of otherworldly perspective. Christians hanging on until the rapture, circling the wagons. What is that? Well, I don't think it's Christian. Not if these people are anything to go by. Engaged in transforming their world and unleashing. Just think about the benefits of the modern world. I know there's problems, but the fact that you go to a dentist and don't suffer in agony, you can thank some of these monks for this kind of thing, because they set this stuff in train. However, towering above all of these amazing developments was the clock. Tick, tick, tick. The ancestor of all modern scientific devices and the first machine made entirely of metal. Now you think about that for a minute. Think about the techniques you had to develop to cut screws and wheels, to get axles working properly. It'd be impossible to understand the modern motor vehicle if they hadn't first developed the clock. And who did it? Monks.
Why? Because they recognized that time, day was created by God in order to worship Him. They broke their doubt into periods of prayer and work, and they needed a clock so they could get this done accurately. To order their day in the proper worship of God. In fact, in the medieval world, intricate city clocks became symbols of civic achievement. Now, you never got that. China had developed some clocks too, but they had so linked the emperor and the heavens with understanding time that they forbade anyone but the most elite to have anything to do with clockmaking. But that wasn't the Western view. Western view was everyone was made in God's image. So it's okay, any monk can experiment with this kind of stuff. And that's why it began to explode. But inventiveness is not science. It's very important to keep that in mind. There's a book by a guy called Dick Teresi, Lost Discoveries. Anyone seen that book? It's quite famous, Lost Discoveries, The Ancient Roots of Modern Science from the Babylonians to the Maya. Anyone seen it, read it? Well, you wander into a bookstore, you'll probably see it on the shelves there. This guy tries to claim that you can actually see the roots of science going way, way, way back into these other periods, and interesting. Problem is, he doesn't really distinguish between myth and history, which is kind of odd in a book devoted to the rise of science. But then secondly, he confuses inventiveness with science, and they're not the same thing. People can be inventive, but that's not the emergence of the scientific worldview. Science involves what? It involves a theoretical system, research, where people seek to formulate explanations of nature, which they then modify through systematic empirical observation. That only happened in Western Europe. Only in Western Europe did you find this thing occurring. And why was it? Why was it? Well, it's simple. When the Western Europeans looked at the world, they saw it through their belief in God. And who was God? God was rational. He was responsive. He was dependable and omnipotent. And the universe was His personal creation. And because of that, it too would have a rational, lawful, stable structure awaiting human comprehension. That's why it never happened in China. In China, it's impersonal principles or essences, and they don't create anything. The universe simply is. There's no reason to suppose it is rational, much less ordained by a rational being. In Greece, the gods are incapable of such creation, and they're too small anyway. Their universe was eternal, uncreated, locked in an endless cycles of progress. Why should you think such a world is rational? And then you look at the gods. Look how they behave. What about Islam? Well, Allah is not conceived of as is the Christian God. The Christian God is seen as a lawful creator. In Islam, Allah is much more active in His creation, often intruding whenever He deems appropriate. Now, with that kind of view, that means to formulate laws of nature was theologically problematic. Why? Because it would limit Allah's ability to engage with His creation. So there was a theological resistance to the formulation of what we would call laws of nature. Now, it's true, Greek learning was kept alive and well for centuries when it was unknown in parts of Europe. But what's interesting is that that learning did not, in fact, develop into a more theoretical program and certainly did not develop into Islamic science. It never happened. So what this means is that although Islamic scholars made notable progress in some very specific fields like astronomy or mathematics, they failed to develop what we would recognize in the West as an overarching theoretical scientific paradigm. They never did that. And as a result, because of this concern about Allah, even what they did have soon began to be stifled, and this limited progress itself ceased. On the other hand, in Western Europe, where the scientific worldview began to develop,
the towering figures of Descartes, Galileo, Newton and Kepler, what do they all have in common? Their absolute belief in the Christian God, which is what undergirded their belief that the universe was rational and designed for us to understand. So science is not an extension of classical learning. Modern science did not come out of the Renaissance. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Modern science is a natural outgrowth of Christian theology. And I would argue Christian theology alone. We gave birth to science. We're not its enemy. So, the so-called Copernican Revolution. You've heard of this. Often presented as a bolt from the blue. One day Copernicus looks up and goes, ah, gazing, and comes up with this great theory that the sun sits at the center and the planets travel around it in circles. But you see, Copernicus was a man of his age, and like Newton, very careful to cover his tracks in terms of where he got his ideas from. If you did that at Regent College, we would call that plagiarism, and you'd fail monumentally. What do you have to do? You must footnote your sources. Well, that was not the way things were done back then. The fact is, much of what Copernicus talked about, he had learnt in Krakow, Bologna, Padua, and Ferrara, where, at that other wondrously Christian innovation, namely the university. You never gather it by looking at the university today, but that also is a Christian innovation. And in those days, thoroughly Christian in their orientation. Founded by Franciscans and Dominicans in particular, who were convinced that Christian faith and reason were not at odds, these universities became the pampered darlings of both popes and empires. Cities would try to attract universities because if they did have a university, the king would give them money, all this kind of stuff, right? What happened in those universities, in these golden geese that so many municipalities tried to attract? Well, rather than rejecting new and unsettling ideas, they in fact studied, debated, and found ways to critique the tradition that had been given to them. That's part of the Christian tradition. In those universities, it wasn't just blind acceptance of what our fathers had told us. They looked at the world and they said, that doesn't fit what Aristotle says. Ptolemy must be wrong here, and they challenged the tradition. That's where science began. This great myth of the Italian Renaissance was launched by the fall of Constantinople, and that's what kicked off the modern period. No, I don't think so. Western scholars had long been reading, critiquing, and engaging with these classical texts. All the Italian Renaissance was really about was, in fact, a revolution in manners, where people began to emulate modes of speech and dress. Yes, they're Italians. Modes of speech and dress of the classical writers and figures. That's about it. Okay? So, far from the Enlightenment freeing dark Europe from the night of Christian ignorance, it was Christian learning in the 11th and 12th centuries that was proceeding apace and provided the foundation for modern science. I could go through all kinds of names here, but I won't because time's getting away from me. Let's get back to Copernicus. He didn't tell us that actually William of Ockham had already rejected the notion that planets need to be pushed because, unlike the Greeks, he said there's no reason why there can't be a vacuum. But the guy who really got it together was Jean Buridan, the rector of the University of Paris, who anticipated Newton's first law of motion. This is 200 years before Newton. And proposed two centuries before Copernicus, that the planets orbited the sun. So Copernicus was borrowing rather freely and not bothering to tell us that that's what he was doing. Albert of Saxony, a rector and a bishop, was already teaching that sunrise and sunset was the product of the Earth's movement 200 years before Copernicus. And it was him, a bishop, in the 13th century, who first began to formulate mathematical principles in order to articulate natural law.
Most of us think that that was Descartes, and it happened much, much later. But here's a bishop in the 13th century who, because he believed God was good and rational, believed that you could come up with mathematical descriptions of the way the natural world operates. That's exactly what modern science is predicated on.
In fact, Leonardo da Vinci seems heavily indebted to the work of this bishop.
Now, how many of us hear about that? Leonardo celebrated, but we're never told. He got some of his most profound ideas about the motion of bodies from a Catholic bishop. Oh, in those days, bishops could be scholars. Something's happened in many Pentecostal and charismatic circles, I'm afraid. But I hope you change that. Our generation's blown a lot of this, but I hope you'll do something different. I hope that when you're in charge of churches and you're on the board of elders, churches will indeed be scintillating places of stunning education and experience of God's presence. Okay? Do what we fail to do. Okay? Go ahead and embarrass us by your excellence. I invite you to do that. Wonderful thing.
Well, in fact, Copernicus contributed very little to this proposal. All he did was to kind of make the point that the solar system would include the sun and then all the planets going around it, not just some. And on just about every other point, he was wrong.
So the idea that he borrowed from somebody else primarily was the one he got right, and the rest,
well, okay, thank you for trying, but no cigar.
Well, the thing you need to know about this is that all of these people, Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, yes, Galileo, were sturdy Christians. And the reason they did science was because they believed in the Christian God behind it. They weren't alone. Albertus Magnus in the 13th century, the best field botanist of the medieval period. In the 13th century, Christian scholars studying botany. That's right, it didn't just begin in the 17th or 18th century with the humanists.
The great breakthroughs in human biology did not come through the Greeks, Romans, Muslims, or the Chinese, but Christian scholastics. The classical world would not permit any kind of tampering with the body. But because Christians believed that what was unique to being human was our soul and not the body, then there was nothing wrong with trying to work out how the body operated. And so two things motivated them. The concern to solve murders. That's right, those dramas you see, we've got these people, forensic scientists. Guess who invented that? Ta-da! Not Hollywood, Christians. Yep, there you go. And to improve human welfare. Now, I don't know if you know this, but or if you had this experience, but when I was at university, the impression I got was you had these wonderful, you know, humanist free thinkers trying to, you know, dissect human bodies, but they did so on pain of death because if the church caught them, they'd be executed. Ever hear that? It's rubbish. It's rubbish. Dissections were happening in church-run universities, fully under the approval of local authorities. Christians doing this because they cared about justice and because they cared about people's health.
Well, what about Galileo? A few words on Galileo, and it's almost time to call this to an end, I think. It is. My wife's nodding up there.
Well, I've got a lot more to say, but let me just say a few things about Galileo.
The popular story about Galileo, well, there's more truth here than there was about Columbus.
He was a giant of science. He was in his old age forced to recant, and he lived out the last 9 years of his life in seclusion. But that's not the whole story. And it's certainly not a case of rank ignorance vainly seeking to forestall irresistible evidence. Copernicus, when he expounded his theory, could hardly believe it himself. In fact, he thought it was so untenable as to be ridiculous. Now, Galileo's evidence, even though it was a bit more scientific in how it was presented, was for all that no more demonstrably true than the old view that somehow the earth was at the centre. It's hard for us to appreciate that. But for these people who are wrestling with it, I mean, even Galileo and Copernicus recognise, you know, this really doesn't make sense. But we think we have to go there because that's the way theory seems to drive us. Now, here's the interesting bit. Cardinal Matteo Barberini was a good friend of Galileo. And in fact, Galileo once dedicated a book to him. Barberini had once even written a book celebrating the glories of astronomy.
Now, why do I mention this guy? Because this guy is soon to become Pope, and he's the one who ends up having a really tough time with Galileo. How could such good friends end up with so much bad blood between them? Well, there are several issues, one of which is Galileo himself. He was a somewhat arrogant person, much given to controversy, rather self-centered, and had an extremely high opinion of himself. People like that, if you've met them, tend not to be very wise in choosing their words. And Galileo was just like that. Now you see, the Reformation is breaking out in Europe. You have to be careful what you say. And his benefactor, his friend Barberini, who's now become the Pope, says to Galileo, look, you can publish your book, that's okay, I want you to do it, just be careful how you express yourself. Speak as a mathematician. Don't try to do theology and you'll be in no trouble whatsoever. That's the Pope's advice to Galileo. And what did Galileo do? Turned the Pope into a completely blithering idiot in his book. In his book, he has someone believing that the earth Galileo. So don't claim it so strongly. Use a word like perhaps or maybe. But that was not Galileo's way. It was Galileo's way or no way. And you don't want to do that when there are powerful people around, and he got himself into trouble. Now, modern scientists are aware of this. You try and publish something in a referee journal that's critical of the theory of evolution and see what happens. I know. I have friends. Convinced Darwinists. Then some other friends began to say, listen, you need to consider the evidence. And they did, and they changed their view. And you know what happened? Suddenly, they no longer are allowed to teach undergraduate classes. Professors, loved by their students, but because they no longer toe the dogma line, excluded from teaching in that way, being marginalised in departments until they really have no contact with anyone. That's happening in the modern world. Wonderful, objective, free-thinking science, as long as you believe the dogma. Raise questions and you're in strife. Well, no different now from what it was then. Well, just to summarise some of this then. As you'll see, if you get to read Rodney Stark, you'll discover that most of the scientists from the 16th to 17th century were very committed and pious Christians. And they did their science because they believed in the God of Christianity. England's so-called scientific revolution was largely carried out by Puritans. Puritans. Right? People you think who were so kind of bound up they could never do anything. Do you know, actually, it was the Puritans who first suggested that sex should be enjoyed for its own sake and not just for procreation? The Puritans. Is that your view of the Puritans? Like making whoopee is actually fun? You know that? You know some of the Puritan preachers in North America, when they were paid, you know what their wages were often? A year's supply of booze. Right? So you've been fed a line about what Puritans were like. Some of them, yes, right? Were a bit kind of retentive in a certain way, right? But many others were not. The Royal Society was largely Puritan in its makeup. And that's now recognised. English science did not grow up rejecting kind of rigid Christianity. It grew out of a vibrant Christian faith. Puritans. Read the stuff about their relationship with God. So where did it all go wrong? Well, it happened with Darwin. And not so much Darwin, but his militant atheistic followers who wanted to use Darwin to rid England of religion. And that didn't begin to happen until the middle of the 19th century. There's a very famous debate with a guy called Bishop Wilberforce. You might have heard of this debate. During this debate, Bishop Wilberforce, it is reported, stood up and made some snide remark, speaking to Huxley, saying, and sir, from which side of your family, you know, do you come from the monkey line, your mother or your father's side? Oh, that's ridiculous. And the report was, Mr. Huxley stood up and said, sir, I feel no shame in descending from a monkey. But I would be terribly ashamed to be associated with somebody like you who uses their gifts to avoid the truth. Now, that's the story, and in nearly every distinguished biography of Darwin and Huxley, you'll find it.
But there's a problem with this story, and you can probably guess what it is.
It's not true. It's not true.
The first evidence of this story comes from when?
It comes from 38 years after the Oxford debate, and guess what exalted tome it's found in? A magazine called A Grandmother's Tales. And it's found its way into these reputedly, historically accurate biographies. It never in fact happened. You go back and read the accounts of people who were there, and there's nothing like that. In fact, it's rather the opposite. What really happened is that Bishop Wilberforce had already written a very learned review of Darwin's book. So he's no ignoramus. In fact, Darwin himself admitted in a letter to his friend that Wilberforce's review was uncommonly clever. It picks out with skill all of the most conjectural parts and brings forward well all the difficulties. It quizzes me quite splendidly. That's Darwin's view of Wilberforce's rebuttal of Darwin's work. In fact, so effective was Wilberforce's critique that Darwin was forced actually to modify later editions of his book to take account of this man's criticisms. Now, here's the question. If it never happened, how come this grandmother's tale graces so many of our learned books? And the answer is, as Rodney Stark points out, for 150 years, there has been a specifically anti-Christian and anti-Catholic agenda in modern Western universities. And it's coming from people who have a social agenda. If you think science is about everybody just asking questions openly and honestly, think again. Especially when it comes to do with questions about what it means to be human. Then there are huge agendas. Just listen to Richard Dawkins, professor at Oxford. Why does he like Darwin? Because it gives him a chance to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. And even if it can't be proved, he'll still go there. Really? You're a scientist, and even though it can't be proved, you'll still go there? Well, that's not because you have any scientific orientation, can I suggest? There's a battle going on here as to what it means to be human and what our society should look like. That's where the real war began. You might have heard of Karl Popper. Heard of him? We'll finish with this. Very famous scientist. He once suggested that evolution as a theory was tautologous, meaning kind of self-contradictory in the way it's set up, and not even a scientific theory. And what he said was basically this. The fittest, what is it? The survival of the fittest. Okay? Okay, well, ask yourself, who are those who survive? Well, they're the fittest, okay? And who are the fittest? They're the ones who survive. It's circular. All you're saying is, the fittest are the fittest. Good, and? Right? When he made that comment, this respected, world-renowned scientist, he was roundly condemned from all sides and subject to all kinds of personal abuse. Why? Because this is not about science, folks. There's something else going on here. And that's where the real split began. Militant atheists wanting to use Darwin as a way of wresting society out of any kind of influence from the Christian worldview. And why do they want to do that? Because if there is a God, then we're responsible to him for how we live. And materialistic atheists don't want that. There is another God. If there is a God, I should say, you have to deal with that. Now, I'm not saying every materialistic atheist comes from that point of view, but that's definitely what's going on with Huxley and others. Now, the point that's interesting is in 1916 they did a survey of how many scientists believed in God. It was about 40%. They did another survey just at the end of last century, that is late 1990s, got the same number. So in the last century, still the same number of scientists work in this field are Christians as there were at the beginning of that century. So what I want to suggest to you today is Christianity at war with science? No. We gave birth to it. The so-called war between Christianity and science is really a war about sociology. It's really a war about what it means to be human. And what often happens is you'll find fundamentalists on either side, fundamentalist Darwinists and fundamentalist Christians, both of whom are not very good at doing science. Now, we should change that. We should change that. It's our inheritance. In fact, Stephen Jay Gould, who is no Christian, chides his colleagues for their straw man presentation of religion as superstition, irrationalism, philistinism, ignorance, and dogma. He says, only those who are utterly, or worse, willfully ignorant of the history of the growth of science could ever make such patently absurd remarks. Many of the best scientists the world has ever seen were what they were, not in spite of their Christian belief, but because of it. We have a heritage, folks. We need to lay hold of it. This is our thing. We began this. This grew out of our worldview. Isn't it time to start integrating it back into mainstream Christian life? I would hope so. Well, it's time to stop. Bless you. And I think the band's going to do something. And I'm going to sit down.